we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to Animal Voices, Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Today is Friday, July 26th, 2019. I'm your host, Elise Jacobson, and I'm joined here in the studio today by my co-host, Sinead Sanders.
Hello.
And our control room operator, Carol Davies McIntosh.
Good afternoon.
The main theme of today's show is bees. We all know how important they are. Their pollinating work makes it possible for us to enjoy all our favorite foods, for one. Unfortunately, there are a lot of common myths surrounding the best ways to help save bees, some of which are driven largely by profit-seeking. No surprise there. Our feature interview today is with Olivia Norfolk, a lecturer in conservation ecology at Anglia Ruskin University in the UK, and a researcher whose work is focused on pollinator species and biodiversity. She will be speaking with us on how keeping honeybees is actually harmful to the many species of wild pollinators already living in our backyards, and she shares some insights on how we can effectively help the unsung heroes of our gardens and farms, that is, wild bees and other pollinators. That's coming up in about half an hour, so stay tuned. And our first interview will be with Omari McQueen, also from the UK, who at just 11 years old is already an award-winning vegan chef and the founder and CEO of his own business called Dipalicious. Omari loves cooking and teaching other kids how to cook, and he'll be sharing with us the story of how he went vegan, how he got started cooking, and what it's like being a kid with his own business. But first, as the theme of this show is bees and busting myths about them, I wanted to talk about some common myths that we encounter, particularly about honeybees and honey. One of the first things that comes to mind for me is something that I've heard going around quite a bit. Some people claim that, you know, eating local honey, you know, honey that comes from the area where you live, can help with allergy symptoms, or, you know, even cure seasonal allergies. I've seen this, you know, at farmers markets, people selling honey and stuff will sort of push this claim. I don't know if either of you have seen this kind of thing before. Carol's shaking her head.
No.
Okay. Yeah. I've heard a few people say this. Yeah. But you know, I've looked it up. If you know me, that's not a surprise. I look everything up. Yeah, and apparently there is absolutely no scientific backing for this. There's, you know, just sort of, it's, what do you call it, a folktale, you know, just sort of a rumor that goes around. So, you know, I think it's, yeah, it's one of those things, again, that I think is pushed by the honey industry, and it sort of seeps into our collective consciousness, and then people are, you know, just sort of accept it as a fact, but it actually is sort of just, you know, an advertising claim that doesn't have any merit. And another thing, yeah, obviously we hear a lot about, you know, honey for when you're sick, you know, if you have a sore throat or a cough and that sort of thing. I think we've all heard about that, probably used that growing up and stuff. But apparently, according to research conducted at Cardiff Metropolitan University in Wales, date syrup was shown to be more effective than honey at combating bacterial infections, like strep throat, for example, which was surprising to me. I wouldn't have... I don't think I've ever used date syrup, actually. I wouldn't have thought of that as, you know, like something that has medicinal properties. But apparently it is very effective at combating bacterial infections, and obviously totally plant-based. So, yeah, I don't know about either of you. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about this. I often get asked why vegans avoid honey. Sinead, do you have any thoughts on that? Like, why would you think it's important to avoid honey?
Yeah, I think it's interesting how when people find out, when people go, oh, you're vegan, so what, you don't even eat honey, and they look at you like you're being super irrational.
Right.
But bees, you know, people are coveting bees. They're like this celebrity right now where people are going, oh, save all the bees, and I'm going, well, and I mean, the people I know who have done beekeeping in their backyards and stuff, they post pictures of the bee carnage, you know, killing bees as they're harvesting honey. Wow. And I'm going, how is it that you are saying, let's save the bees, but you are okay with killing them for something that you don't actually need?
You know? So
from my perspective, it's just sort of live and let live. Like, why would I want something that I don't need and that causes suffering? And like, why kill needlessly? It's like any other animal product. If you can do without it, then why wouldn't you want to?
I totally agree. And I think, I mean, for me, even beyond, you know, if somebody argues, oh, but I don't kill any of my bees, at least not intentionally, I think that, you know, you just have to think about, why do honeybees make honey? You know, they make it for themselves, for their own colonies, for their own use. And, you know, they don't make it for us. I think I remember reading recently a honeybee only makes about what, a teaspoon of honey or something in their entire lifetime. It's sort of like just this tiny amount, and it's their entire life's work for a bee. So, you know, and obviously they use it themselves.
I think it's a quarter of a teaspoon.
Is that right?
It's
a quarter of a teaspoon.
Tiny.
Right.
Very,
okay.
Very tiny.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I think that's just, for me, you know, that's just something to think about. They make it for themselves. They don't make it for us. So if we have alternatives, then might as well use the alternatives and just leave them alone and, you know, let them use the products of their own work. And speaking of alternatives, there are tons of alternatives to honey. For example, agave syrup, maple syrup. You know, obviously in Canada, we're famous for maple syrup. Our maple syrup is the best in the world here. And, you know, it's, yeah, so delicious. And actually, maple syrup has vitamins and minerals in it. There's, you know, some nutritional value to it for a sweetener. Brown rice syrup. Sinead, have you ever used brown rice syrup?
Yeah, absolutely. It, yeah, it's definitely got, yeah, a more similar texture to honey than maple syrup. And
yeah,
it can be used in all sorts of things.
Yeah, it's not too terribly sweet, and it's very thick. And and there's even a product, actually a few different products now, that, yeah, there's a company called Bee Free Honey, and I think there are other companies that are making, you know, honey alternatives that are plant-based. I've tried Bee Free Honey. It's made from apples. And it tastes exactly like honey. You would never know the difference. It's so delicious. If you ever wanted to make anything where you need, you know, something that's sort of a honey flavor or something, that's exactly what you would want to do. Yeah, any other thoughts about this?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is something that our listeners will hear more about later in the show. But yeah, one of the common misconceptions is that keeping honeybees, and, you know, we need to keep eating honey and keeping honey beehives, because otherwise there will be no more bees, and like, we need to support the bee populations. But honeybees, as you will hear, are just one out of thousands of native bee species here in Canada. There are 4,000 species of bees in Canada, and honeybees are domesticated. They come from Europe. And so, as our feature interview will describe for you, Olivia Norfolk says that keeping honeybees to protect wild pollinators is like farming chickens to save wild birds. So it's really not helping the bees that need help.
Yeah, I love that analogy, actually. That's that really drives the point home. And I can't wait to hear that interview. I think that's going to be great.
And now for a bit of news. This story was just published in the Daily Hive yesterday. A group of Vancouver-based animal advocates are fighting to persuade Vancouver City Council to rezone the new grounds of St. Paul's Hospital so that the facility's labs are not able to perform experiments on animals. So the campaign was launched by UBC adjunct professor and retired municipal lawyer Patricia Kendall, and it's called Rezoning for the Animals. And since May, they've been trying to gather signatures for a public petition and increase awareness of animal testing at St. Paul's. They held a demo at Broadway and Cambie a couple of weeks ago, July 13th, and they gathered nearly 200 names on the petition, and they distributed hundreds of flyers. And so the new St. Paul's Hospital is expected to open in 2026, and it'll be in False Creek. They're moving from their old downtown location, and so with the permits and the zoning conditions and everything that they're dealing with there, the hospital requires rezoning from Vancouver City Council to legally permit the land uses, and one of the land uses is laboratory. So what we're trying to do here is make the specifications so that the laboratory excludes animal testing, and which is really important. You can go to our website, animalvoices.org, and just search animal testing, and you will find a number of interviews with different scientists and doctors who describe the ineffectiveness of testing on animals and how it's actually been really harmful, because it's not effective, right? So this sounds like a really important campaign to be paying attention to, rezoning for the animals. And the group's main concern is that if animal experimentation is not specifically addressed by the city council before the rezoning, then the hospital will decide after rezoning to allow animal testing, and then it'll be too late to address the issue. So you can support them by looking them up online, rezoning for the animals, and the next public campaign will be held on August 10th at 1 o'clock outside the Broadway Canada Line station. And and you can also send a letter to Vancouver City Council and just let them know your thoughts, because animal testing is not something that we need to do anymore.
Absolutely. And, it's time to move forward and, you know, innovate, discover new alternatives.
Absolutely. And speaking of innovating and finding new alternatives, fast food chain Tim Hortons has expanded its vegan options once again with the addition of Just Egg vegan omelets at select Canadian locations. As far as I know, the test locations are in Ontario.
Yes, that's what I heard too.
Yeah, but when they were doing the testing for the Beyond Sausage stuff, then it wasn't very long before they started showing up here. So that's wonderful. Just Egg, for those who don't know, it's a mung bean based egg alternative, and apparently it's really good. I haven't tried it myself yet.
I tried it once in Miami a few months ago, and it's pretty uncanny how much it tastes and has a mouthfeel like scrambled eggs. It's crazy.
Right on. Yeah.
I actually couldn't believe my eyes when I saw that about Tim Hortons. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. Yeah. They've historically been so bad for vegan options, and now all of a sudden in the last couple months they're like on a roll. That's great.
Yeah, it really is. And they now have burgers for the first time ever. They have burgers.
Right.
And
Beyond
only,
Burgers, right?
Yeah, they don't have meat-based burgers. They have Beyond Burgers only, which is
cool.
Cool. And because if we have alternatives to these things that are causing so much suffering and environmental destruction, then, you know, why not reach for these other options, and through these big chains putting these things out there just gives everyone an opportunity to try. So go out and try it, people.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Sinead. And moving on, my first guest today is Omari McQueen, an 11-year-old award-winning vegan chef and the founder and CEO of Dipalicious, a UK-based company specializing in delicious plant-based dips and snacks. Hello, Omari, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Yes, great to hear you. So first of all, tell me a little bit about how you discovered your passion for cooking. How old were you when you started cooking, and what got you into it?
Well, the way I started cooking was when my mom was sick and my dad was going to work. Then when my mom was sick, my dad taught me and my big brother how to cook, and because my big brother's passion wasn't cooking, he didn't want to cook anymore, so I was cooking. And then since then, I was 7, and now I love cooking.
Oh, that's fantastic. Wow. So, right. So you had to help out when your mom was sick. Everybody in the family had to pitch in. Hey, so that's great. Wow. Yeah. 7 years old. Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. Great. So I'd also love to hear about your vegan journey. How long have you been vegan and what inspired you to make the switch?
It's because when I was researching about veganism, and I saw this video from Peter UK, then it showed me how animals have been treated for food and clothes, and I didn't like the way that happened, so I wanted to become vegan.
Wow, so how old were you when you saw this video?
Was 8.
8 years old, and it affected you. Hey, that's amazing. Is anyone else in your family vegan, or are you the only one?
I'm the only one.
Wow, that's incredible.
No. Me and my big brother, and the one after me.
Oh, you and your big brother? Okay, great.
They're plant-based, yeah.
Sorry, say that one more time?
They're plant-based. So he's converted his older brother and his brother underneath him.
Oh, that's fantastic. How lovely. For our listeners, that's Omari's mom, Leah. Hi, Leah.
Hi.
So, Omari, what do you love most about cooking?
That everyone loves my food.
Oh, well, that's great. And what do you love most about vegan cooking specifically?
Bringing people together for food without harming animals.
That's so lovely. Yeah, I love that you're so succinct about that. That's great. So I understand that you run cooking workshops for kids out of your home. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I do run cooking restaurants for kids. It's to help them how to cook. Like, if their mom's sick and they went through what I went through, then they could cook for the family as well.
That's so wonderful. So how many kids usually attend your workshops?
10.
Wow, okay, that's a pretty big group. And what kinds of things do you teach them?
Just how to cook and how to be safe in the kitchen as well.
Great, okay. Can you tell us some of the dishes that you've taught these kids to make?
Vegan pizza, vegan patties, vegan shepherd's pie.
There's loads, aren't there?
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Wow, it sounds delicious. So what advice would you have for other kids or people of any age who would like to go vegan?
That rule number 5, that they should stay humble, be themselves, and your flaws make you unique. And you're never too young or old to start your own business.
Oh, that's so lovely. Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah, I was going to ask you about starting your own business, but that's great. Do you have any other advice for kids who would want to start a vegan business?
That they should carry on trying, never give up, and they should follow their passion.
That's lovely. Yeah, that's great advice. So what are your dreams or goals for the future?
I would like a food restaurant.
That's already happening.
Well, having a restaurant in Box Park, Croydon, on the August. And the date is 17th to the 24th. And what I would like is I would like to sell my dips all over the world with a bus restaurant, and yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, tell me more about that. So you want to have your own bus restaurant, like a food truck?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
You want to have like a double-decker bus restaurant.
Wow. Oh, so you there would be seating inside?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. And what kind of food would you serve there?
Vegan food.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's lovely. Can you tell us a little bit? You mentioned your pop-up that's coming up in August. Can you tell us more about what that's going to look like?
I'm going to have a restaurant in Box Park, as I said. And it's going to be on the...
What is it going to look like in the restaurant?
Oh, it's going to have a kitchen, but the kitchen's the most biggest thing there. And then it has this,
It's got a big open space.
Yeah. Big open space, yeah. But there's a big, big, big space for everyone to sit. And...
What are you doing on the Monday?
On the Monday... I'm going to do a carnival, a kiddie carnival, and I could tell you one of the meals I'm going to be selling, but all of the other meals are going to be a surprise. So this one is barbecue jackfruit with jerk breadfruit chips.
Wow.
And some plantain.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Very cool. And you said all the other dishes on the menu are going to be a surprise?
Yeah.
Oh, lovely. Well, gee, I wish I was in the UK so I could come. I hope that that lots of people go. Well, thank you so much for coming on Animal Voices today, Omari and Leah. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and we wish you all the best in your endeavors.
By the way, it's a Caribbean thing.
Oh, great. Oh, very cool. That's lovely. Well, best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye. We've been speaking with Omari McQueen, 11-year-old founder and CEO of his own vegan food business. If you'd like to learn more about Omari and his business, Dipalicious, visit dipalicious.co.uk. That's DIPALICIOUS.
Come on and sting me. When I first met you, I felt a strange sensation. Couldn't understand what you could do to a man. I know when you make love, it's like the sting of a bee. Come on now, baby, do your thing for me. Hey, bumblebee, come on and sting me. Hey, bumblebee. You the best, don't stand out from the rest. Girl, you got the chance tonight to make everything alright. Come on and make your flight, sting me with all your might. Hey, bumblebee, come on and sting me. Hey, bumblebee, come on and get busy with me.
Love that song. That was Wilson Pickett with Bumblebee.
You're listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM, CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio, and Vancouver, BC, Canada, Coast Salish Territories. And now for some events. Tomorrow, Saturday, July 27th, is the Vancouver Vegan Festival at Creekside Park, right next to Science World there. This is a free, all-ages celebration of animal-free food and culture located at the beautiful waterfront, Creekside Park. There will be over 70 vendors, plus DJs and speakers and free yoga and social justice groups and more. And yeah, I'm looking forward to
it. Yeah, me too. I'm totally going to go. I think it's going to be great.
Yeah, we've had events like this before. We've had Vancouver Veg Fest. The last one was on Granville Street a couple of years ago, but this is the first sort of event of its kind in a couple of years, I think, that that we've had a big outdoor thing like this. And and yeah, you know, I kind of wanted to say too that if you hear the term vegan festival and you feel like it isn't for you, like you don't identify as vegan and why should you go, just remember that veganism is actually, like, it exists to benefit everybody.
You know? Absolutely.
And, you know, it's just basically saying let's not cause needless suffering, and I think that's something that a lot of people actually do identify with. So, you know, it's just about trying to live by your values as best you can. And yeah, so this is a great place to explore that kind of thing. You know, if you're going, what are people talking about with this vegan thing, then just go for a sunny walk down to Creekside Park and right by Science World, Main Street Science World Skytrain. And yeah, check out all the vendors and all the groups that are working to just make the world a better place. And lots of great people, lots of great speakers. Anna Pippis will be speaking about her blog, Easy Animal Free, just helping people to make easy vegan food. You know, it doesn't have to be fancy or complicated, but it is almost always, in my experience, my 10 years of eating vegan food experience, delicious. Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And what are some of the other speakers we have tomorrow?
I know that Asha Wielden is speaking at noon. We've had her on the show before. She's from Kula Foods, an Afro-vegan food company in Vancouver, and they make incredible food. I believe she's doing like a cooking demo, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's at noon.
Yep.
So I'm going to try to make it out for that because, yeah, she's great.
Yeah. And then after that, from 1 until 2, there is a zero waste vegan workshop with Tasha Lobsinger of Peace People Project, which is one of the groups that is actually presenting this event. And yeah, she's showing people how to make your own oat milk and toothpaste. And
wow.
And oat milk is delicious. And
oh, yeah.
It is so easy, and it is so cheap. And yeah, highly recommends that people check this out. So this will take place tomorrow from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Creekside Park, right next to Science World. And family-friendly, dog-friendly. Yeah, go check it out.
Cool.
and it is a big weekend for animal rights events here in Vancouver. On Sunday, July 28th, come together in roaring silence to peacefully demonstrate the suffering of animals exploited across the globe. Roaring silence is a demonstration that is a global thing. It happens all over the world. This is the third year that it's happened in Vancouver. Basically people get together and hold signs, and Carol, you had a good description for it earlier.
It's like a funeral march because everybody's silent and you're just holding the signs with pictures of the animals on it. All the signs and everything are provided for people so they don't have to bring their own. Nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a good way for, in my experience, I went to the first one a couple of years ago, and for people who want to speak out for animals and aren't okay with what's happening to them, but you aren't comfortable necessarily talking to the public, like going to a protest and chanting or engaging in outreach and speaking to strangers about stuff. If you aren't into that, but you still want to go and speak out for the animals, this is a good place to do it, because you're just marching and you're holding signs and photos of what happens and just showing it to people. And
okay.
And that's powerful.
Mm-hmm.
So that takes place 11 a.m. until 3 p.m. at Emery Barnes Park this Sunday. That's that little park that's next to the Van City Theater there at Davie Street and Richard Street. And then the march will go through downtown. And yeah, it's really, I think, a powerful event. I remember when I went last time, it's odd because I was walking down the street holding a sign that said, end traditions that torture.
Mm-hmm.
And you have people coming out, lots of people expressing their support, but you have people saying, boo, you know,
wow.
like, boo, no, I disagree with that.
It's yay,
like,
torture.
Yeah, you know, yeah. It's like, end traditions that torture, how can you argue with that, right?
Right.
But people have this stuff so ingrained in their heads. So, once again, Vancouver Vegan Festival tomorrow, Saturday, starting 11 a.m. at Creekside Park. And then Roaring Silence taking place at Emery Barnes Park at 11 a.m. on Sunday. And also on Sunday, the Vancouver Humane Society is presenting a talk with Dr. Lisa Kramer at the Library Conference Center at 350 West Georgia Street. And Dr. Lisa Kramer, along with the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society of BC, will be talking about animal testing, animals and drug testing, and explaining once again why this is that the animal modeling is ineffective. It's misleading to scientists, and it's not effective. It's dangerous. So that takes place Sunday night, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Library Square Conference Center. And admission is $10. You can find more information at vancouverhumanesociety.bc.ca. And if you have any other animal-related events you'd like to have announced on the show, you can send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com.
Guest today is Dr. Olivia Norfolk, a lecturer in conservation ecology at Anglia Ruskin University in the UK, and a researcher whose work is focused on pollinator species and biodiversity, including interactions between domesticated honeybees and wild bees. Hello, Olivia, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Nice to meet you.
So first of all, we've heard in the news a lot over the last few years that bee populations are in decline around the world. Can you elaborate a bit on what this means exactly and what's causing it?
Yeah, so our pollinator populations are plummeting across the entire planet. The primary cause of these declines is basically the way that we're managing our land. So agriculture is the biggest problem. We've converted like huge areas of natural habitat into intensive farms that contain just one or two crop species. And there really just isn't enough for the pollinators to visit. There aren't enough flowers, basically. And combined with that, the lack of food is also the use of pesticides. So our farmland tends to be doused in chemicals that can kill some insects, but also just reduce their ability to reproduce and survive.
When we talk about pollinators, bees, and more specifically honeybees, are often what first comes to mind. But bees are far from the only species that we have and rely on for pollination. So what are some of the lesser known pollinator species that are in jeopardy?
So when I talk to people in the UK about pollinators and bees, they normally just think about the honeybee. And they're quite surprised when I tell them that there's actually at least 250 species of wild solitary bee in the UK. The situation is totally different over in North America and Canada. So you have over 4,000 wild bee species. So there are a huge number of different organisms that are involved in pollination. And it's not just bees. You've got butterflies, you've got flies and hoverflies. And you've also got vertebrates, so you've got things like hummingbirds and even bats who are all really important in maintaining plant pollination.
How about wasps? They seem to get described as the mean, pesky, non-pollinating cousin of bees, but do wasps play a role in pollination as well?
So wasps do also feed on nectar, but they're not as hairy as bees, so they tend not to be as efficient as pollinators. But they are still really important in ecosystems, and they get a really bad name. But they do a lot of important things in terms of pest control. So they tend to predate and eat smaller insects that can damage our crops, damage plants in our gardens. And there are also a lot of species of wasps that are parasitoids. So they actually lay their eggs right inside another insect, which then hatches out and eats that insect from the inside, which sounds horrible. But often those insects are herbivores that are damaging crops. Mm-hmm. So they do actually have an important role.
Absolutely. Everyone plays a role. And going back to the pollinators, why is it important to maintain a diverse array of pollinator species rather than relying on just a few types of bees to do all the pollinating for us?
Yeah, so there's two reasons here. One is that some plant species are very specialized and they can only be pollinated by a specific insect or animal species. So if you lose their pollinator, that plant will die. They have no other option. They're specialized. Other plants actually benefit from having a range of pollinators visiting them, because if you look at the bees out in your garden, you'll see they're all different shapes and sizes. Some of them collect pollen in different locations, on their bellies or on their back legs. Some of them tend to get covered all over. And by having a combination of different shaped bees and visitors, you actually get better pollen transfer and significantly better yield. So diversity is really key to maintaining pollination.
We've been hearing quite a bit about people taking up backyard beekeeping, keeping honeybees specifically, in an effort to help declining bee populations. You've argued that this can actually do more harm than good, though. So why is that?
First, it's really great to hear that people are taking notice of the plight of the pollinators and trying to do something good. So I don't want to criticize anyone for taking up beekeeping. But it's really important to remember that these animals are domesticated. Essentially, this is equivalent to somebody setting up a chicken farm with the aim of conserving wild birds. Conserving honeybees does nothing for the rest of the other 4,000 bee species. And actually, it makes things worse, because unlike chickens, these honeybees can fly out of their hives into the natural environment where they directly compete with the struggling wild bees for the floral resources. So hungry wild bees are kind of getting mobbed and knocked off flowers by hungry honeybees.
Mm-hmm. I've read that that many of the native bee species, they're solitary and they live in the ground. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the majority of wild bee species are solitary. Some of them nest in the ground, so they often find sandy areas of soil. Some of them also like to nest in old plant stems or cavities in buildings or even in old trees. So there's a really wide variety of nesting habits, all which need to be catered for in our landscapes, in our gardens, and in our cities.
So they may not be the hive-dwelling, honey-producing bees that we're used to thinking about, but the native bee species are still definitely playing a significant role in our ecosystem.
Yeah, exactly. And they are ensuring that we get to eat a lot of the fruits that we love to eat. So it's not just about honey, you know, it's about blueberries, it's about strawberries and raspberries. There's a lot that we love that comes directly from these wild bees.
Mm-hmm. All these foods that we're used to eating, they can't all be pollinated just by honeybees.
No, and particularly things like blueberries and actually a lot of American crops, the Solanaceae, so things like tomatoes and cucumbers and aubergines all require a special type of pollination called buzz pollination. And honeybees can't do it. Basically, their pollen is very tightly held in their anthers, and it requires a bee to come up and buzz and make a very low vibrating sound, which then triggers the releasing of the pollen. Honeybees can't do it, so they simply can't pollinate these crops. So we really do need to keep a variety of wild species if we want to keep enjoying the food that we love.
Mm-hmm. You've also written about how the trade in honeybees can spread diseases to wild pollinators. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so particularly across America, you often find truckloads of honeybee hives being kind of moved up and down the country in according to the flowering times of the crops. This can spread disease within the honeybee hives and across locations very quickly, of things like varroa mite and deformed wing virus. But what it can also do is infect local wild bee populations. So it has been found that diseases and parasites can hang around on the flowers. So if a honeybee has been there and the disease has been transmitted, they don't have to come in direct contact with the wild bee. Simply visiting the same plants is enough to infect the bees. Mm-hmm. So there is a real risk there.
So from what you said, it sounds like releasing domesticated honeybees into an area is kind of like dropping an ecological bomb on the local species of wild bees, who are the ones that are actually struggling. But there's still this increase in people starting up honeybee hives and harvesting honey out of their backyards or on the roofs of their buildings, who say they're doing it because they want to help save the bees. So since amateur beekeeping is obviously turning out to be more harmful than helpful, what can everyday people do to help strengthen wild bee populations and contribute to pollinator diversity?
Yeah, so if you're thinking about getting a honeybee hive to help wild pollinators, my advice would be don't. Plant some flowers. Really, it's as simple as that. The biggest problem that our wild pollinators are facing is that they can't find enough food. So if you have a garden or even just a roof, think about planting flowers that are rich in nectar and pollen. Think about maybe reducing the amount of weeding you do. Next time you've got a few weeds coming up and you see a few bees visiting them, think maybe, are they doing any harm? Maybe you could leave them there for a few extra weeks before doing your weeding. So really just planting more flowers and reducing the intensity of our gardening practices to make sure that wildlife can thrive.
There's this idea in our culture that a perfect garden should have a perfectly manicured lawn and everything should be perfectly trimmed and tidy. But it sounds like if we want to help bees, we've got to let go of that idea. And a perfect yard for bees would be one where, even if people might think it looks a bit messy, native plants are allowed to grow and the landscape is allowed to stay somewhat wild.
Yeah, exactly. And there have been studies that show that reducing the amount you mow your lawn in your garden can dramatically increase the number of flowering plants, such as clovers, and in turn increase the bumblebee numbers. So reducing your mowing to less than twice a week is a really great first step for helping the bees. And there's some great initiatives going on in the UK. So a charity called Plant Life has been campaigning to stop the regular mowing of our roadside verges. So at the moment, governments and councils tend to just mow all the plants away for ease of management. But people are campaigning to get the wildflowers growing back by the side of the road. And that will really do good for our wild bees.
Yeah, that sounds like a great initiative. So for those who want to plant flowers to help support bees, are there species that are particularly effective or any types of flowers that we should be avoiding?
So you will find that there are some ornamental flowers that have been bred over generations to produce really big, showy flowers, but actually don't contain much nectar or pollen or are actually completely sterile. So it's best to ask at your local garden centres if they know what products are best for bees, because it's also very important to try to plant native flowers that come from Canada. So for me as a UK scientist, I don't want to incorrectly advise you on which flowers would be best for your bees.
Mm-hmm.
that asking your garden centres, having a bit of a look online is a way to find out. But also, have a look in your garden, you know, go out there on a sunny day and see what those bees are visiting, and learn from that and plant more of them.
Mm-hmm. In my own backyard, there are several wildflowers that we just leave to grow. Foxgloves and, you know, you'd mentioned clovers and buttercups and dandelions, which are too often dismissed as just weeds and torn out. But for flowers to plant, we do have loads of online resources. David Suzuki's website has a good page on how to create pollinator-friendly gardens and suggests a whole list of things like sunflowers, heather, yarrow, blueberry, raspberry, the list goes on. And also flowering herbs like lavender and chives. And actually, we've been growing basil on the back porch. And, you know, they say to pinch off the flowers so you get more leaves, but the bees were going crazy for the basil flowers, so we've started leaving some for them.
Yeah, exactly. I've done the same with my fennel. Let things flower, let them go to seed. It's part of the natural cycle of life, and it's what our wildlife need to thrive.
It kind of goes back to this human habit of judging plants and non-human animals based on how they can serve us. You know, these plants exist so we can have these things, and these animals exist so we can have these things. But we're not actually the center of the natural world. Humans are primates and part of the animal kingdom alongside bees and all the other animals. And just because a plant or animal seems expendable to us doesn't mean it's not valuable to other species who we ultimately do depend on and are meant to be sharing this planet with. You know, they have inherent value in and of themselves, regardless of what they can do for us.
They do, but from another inherently selfish perspective, if you start to care about the bees, they can bring you real joy. So you go out into your garden and you see a dandelion that you wanted to rip up last week. But once you love the bees and love nature, if you see some bees visiting it, it brings you joy and happiness, and it reduces the amount of weeding you have to do.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. And apart from planting native flowers and allowing wildflowers to grow, people can help support wild bees by creating something called a bee hotel in their yard. So can you tell us, what is a bee hotel?
Yeah, so bee hotels is a bit of a kind of commercial gimmick. For, it's basically normally in a log, and it's filled with bamboo tubes that have cavities for bees to nest in. So this is targeting those cavity nesting bees that naturally would have maybe nested in dead plant stems that they would have found on the ground, or in holes in walls, or holes in old trees. Now they're struggling to find anywhere to nest, primarily because we've kind of concreted over a lot of their habitat. We've got too much decking, too many immaculate lawns. And by getting a bee hotel, it just offers a little somewhere for them to call home.
Mm-hmm, that sounds great. I'm going to get started this weekend. And you're in the UK, but are there any particular resources that you'd recommend to our listeners to access more information on how to help bees?
So here in the UK, we've got some brilliant charities that would provide an overview. So we have the Bumblebee Trust, we have Butterfly Conservation, Plant Life, who've been campaigning to reflower our road verges. I'm not an expert on your Canadian charities, so I wouldn't want to point you in the wrong direction. But generally, there is a lot of information out there on the internet if you have a look. Just try to make sure you're getting it from a reputable and respected charity or source.
For sure. Are there any last thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners on the topic of bees and how we can help them?
Just really that it is possible to get a greener, buzzier future. If we all work together and make a concerted effort to reflower our gardens, reflower our road verges, and get our cities buzzing again, it really is possible and it really is worth it.
Well, thank you so much, Olivia, for joining us on Animal Voices today and sharing your knowledge and insight with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Olivia Norfolk, lecturer in conservation ecology at Anglia Ruskin University in the UK. Excellent interview. Thank you for taking care of that, Sinead. So did you have any thoughts wrapping up? I found that so informative and fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wished I could have spoken with her for longer, actually. I just, yeah, so many questions, and I had been doing some reading before and after speaking with her about all the different bee species that we have here, and I'd encourage anybody to look online. There, we don't seem to have any specific bee charities that are really local here, but we do have scientists in Canada who are working on wild bee conservation, absolutely. And actually, one thing that showed up on CBC's website yesterday, there is now an app that you can get called Bumblebee Watch, and so you can help bees by taking pictures of the bees in your yard, and then through the app you send them to the scientists, and then the scientists collect the information, and I think that's another great way to do things, and cool. They said, you know, it's easier than building a bee hotel.
Yeah,
or gardening so for those who don't have garden space but want to help the bees, then check out the Bumblebee Watch app.
Yeah.
And you know, at the beginning of the interview there, she mentioned that the biggest cause, the biggest threat of to pollinators and the biggest cause of pollinator decline has been agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And
habitat loss from
And as we've discussed on the show before, animal agriculture is the number one cause of habitat loss for all sorts of wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
So it just sort of brings it back again to, you know, if you want to help the bees, then what you eat, honey or not, makes a difference.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So, going vegan can help the bees in a big way. I kind of wanted to touch on something really quick. I hadn't expected to talk about this on the show, but I had a little issue recently where I was allowing my lawn. I live in a house, I rent a house, and I was allowing the front lawn to kind of grow a little bit wild, you know, and, grow some dandelions and other plants that people consider quote unquote weeds. And apparently a disgruntled neighbor reported my house to the city, and I received an order to mow the lawn, to like cut the weeds down or the plants down. And I was really upset by this because it had a very active ecosystem. There were a lot of bees out there. And, as I was out there cutting down the weeds, I was like cutting down, plants, flowers that bees were actively feeding on. And it just absolutely broke my heart. What I plan to do and what I hope other people will do is write to city council, write to, you know, MPs in Vancouver, and ask them to consider changing the bylaw that requires people to kind of have manicured mowed lawns. Or I think it's that you have to sort of, every lawn has to be sort of the same in the neighborhood or something. Otherwise,
mm-hmm.
They can report you and make you cut it down or something. But, you know, we're just like, the climate is in crisis. We really need our pollinators. We really need, you know, to help them as much as we possibly can. So,
mm-hmm.
And even Olivia said in the interview, you know, it's best if you don't mow your lawn as much, if you kind of let some wild plants grow in your yard, it's really best for pollinators.
Yeah. So, just allowing wild spaces to exist. And once again, you know, Oxford researchers have said that a vegan dietary shift would require 75% less global farmland, and allowing lots, that's, yeah, 75% less. Just imagine how much space would be left for native pollinators to do their thing and help our planet go in a healthy direction rather than the one we appear to be going in.
Absolutely. Yeah, something to think about. You've been listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Join us here again next Friday, August 2nd at noon for more animal-friendly programming. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Visit our website, animalvoices.org, where you can stream past shows and download them as podcasts. You can also see our show blog there with detailed links and subscribe to us on iTunes. Stay in touch with us on Facebook and Instagram at Animal Voices Vancouver and on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. And now we'll leave you with a song. In keeping with the bee theme of today's show, here is the Scottish National Orchestra performing Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov's classic Flight of the Bumblebee. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.